Welcome, everybody, to the Nutrition Network. Today, we are extremely privileged to have one of our fellow conspirators in life, another nutritional therapist, Helen Adams, who has written a book called I Don't Know What to Eat. And I think this is something that lots of people and their clients might be struggling with these days. And it is all about food allergies, intolerances, and sensitivities. So, Helen, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. I'm really good today. And how are you?
Good. Absolutely fab. Thank you. The sun is shining, so that's always nice. Although it's in the evening, it's still shining, which is nice, but soon it won't be. So let's take advantage where we can. So, Helen, do you want to tell us about where you qualified, you know, your journey a little bit, and how you got to this point of writing a book?
Okay, so I'll start at the end and then go backwards for reasons which will become clear. So I did my nutrition qualification with the College of Naturopathic Medicine in Bristol, which is my nearest college. And following that, I then did a further qualification in functional medicine with the Institute for Functional Medicine. I'm just coming up to my exam now, my final exam for that. And, you know, all the time you're always learning, running a nutrition business, as we all know. But I did find that after a while there became a pattern in the sort of people who found me. Let's put it like that. And I think the reason for that was very much to do with the reason why I came into nutrition in the first place, which was due to my son. So my son was born premature, and he had digestive issues really since birth, but eating was just a real problem, and we just never seemed to get to the bottom of, well, why does he not want to eat? Why can't he eat? And anyway, as the years went on, he became more and more ill. By the time he was four, he was not thriving, very much underweight, very fatigued, struggling. And we took him to see all sorts of therapists, all sorts of medical practitioners, pediatricians. We did the rounds, as you do. I hadn't trained in nutrition at that point, so I was doing this as a member of the public, you know, just trying to find out whatever I could. And at one point, he was told, well, food intolerances seem to be a big issue. So, you know, you can't have any gluten, you can't have any dairy, you can't have eggs, you can't have yeast, you can't have sugar. And there were so many things that were taken out of the really limited range of foods that he was eating that it was almost a question of, well, there's just nothing left. And trying to manage cooking for a family with a child like that alongside that, you know, it's very, very difficult. So eventually in our journey through various types of therapists, we came across a nutritional therapist, and she really helped put us on the right track. So she, you know, told us how to start introducing him to vegetables, those things we love so much, including broccoli, of course. And, you know, gradually, over some time, he got better. So he went from being underweight, undernourished, couldn't go to school, diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome. He went from that state to being a healthy adult. He's now 22. He's at university. He's gone off back to university for his final year, and he plays sport. He's very active, a completely different person than that sick child. And so food intolerances have always been really dear to my heart, because I thought there really should be another way apart from just take all these things out. There's got to be another answer, and that can't be right. So during all my training, I really have always had that in the back of my mind. And, well, yes, you understand what food intolerances are, but how can you do more to help people who are in a similar situation at whatever age of life they are? So that's really where my interest came. And then when I started to sort of be more active in what I was doing, so I'm also a presenter for BBC Radio Wiltshire, and very often they phone me and ask me to do all, you know, talk about all sorts of things. But for my clients, I like to be able to recommend resources to them, as well as the material that I give them. And I like to be able to say, well, you know, here's all the stuff from me, but if you want to look into it more deeply, have a look at this book. So I looked for a book on food intolerances, and I just couldn't really find anything. I couldn't find anything that sort of gave them enough of the science without overloading them, and also gave them, a nutritionist view on foods and what was good and what was not good and why. So I thought, okay, I'll write one myself. So I did. And over some time, it took shape. I didn't really have a clear idea when I started it quite how it would end up, but the feedback I've had, it was published in January 2018, and the feedback I've had since it launched has been, you know, very good. I find that actually a lot of nutritional therapists have used it, because again, in our nutrition training, I think we don't, you know, we get training on, yes, this is what a food intolerance is, but we don't really get more than that. And I think for us to understand that more, it means we can answer those difficult questions that come from our clients. And again, that gives them confidence in what we know and what we do.
Well, thank you very much for that. It's always interesting to know how we've emerged into this journey. Are you doing the functional medicine training in order to sort of augment where you are as a nutritional therapist, in terms of understanding that food intolerance puzzle further, or what's your thinking behind that?
Well, I didn't do it specifically for that, but it has actually helped. Certainly, oral allergy syndrome, which is one thing I do mention in the book, there was more information about that on the functional medicine course, which I thought, oh, this is really interesting. Although most of what they say is stuff that, through the functional medicine training, is stuff that I've already found out about because it's my specialist topic. But I wanted to do functional medicine just because really I wanted to know more about the why. Why do things happen? You know, why? So if somebody has whatever condition, you know, why is that? What can we do about it? How do all the bits link together? And then what are all the small things that you can influence that will improve that condition? So rather than just think, oh, right, you know, like the doctors do, it's the magic bullet. Well, we know that really there isn't a magic bullet, but there might be lots of, little things that really are magic when you put them together.
Well, I think that's the difference, isn't it, between sort of us as nutritionists and doctors. It's just like, doctors would think there's a magic bullet or not, whereas obviously we know that there's a huge jigsaw puzzle to do and you need to put them all together to get the picture, as opposed to seeing it all as different parts and not putting it together. It's impossible like that. Mm. So do you think or do you know that different foods cause different symptoms, or is it it's just the individual is causing different symptoms then?
Food intolerances can cause just about any symptom, but there are certain patterns in the clients that come to me. So, for example, people who have conditions like fibromyalgia or, you know, those sort of pain-related conditions, arthritis, very much so, those sort of things, I find very often they have sensitivity to nightshades. And the nightshades are the things like potatoes, tomatoes, aubergines, peppers, red peppers, cayenne pepper even. So those sort of foods very, very much influence pain. And, of course, in the wild, there is a toxin in those plants that's supposed to deter predators. But when you think of the size of a caterpillar compared to the size of one of us, for most people, it really, you know, we just don't really take any notice of that toxin. But a few people can be sensitive to it. And with the nightshade family, it's a cumulative effect. So if you had, let's say on a Monday, you had some tomatoes for lunch, and on Tuesday you had some potatoes for dinner. I didn't mention potatoes, they're nightshades as well. And then on Wednesday you had some aubergines. You know, you're adding to your toxic load each time. You're adding to that threshold, which those toxins stay in your body for about 3 days. So you can, without realizing it, you can find that actually you're ramping up the threshold quite a bit. And then if you add to that, that maybe the potatoes you used, you didn't keep them in the dark. So if you stress them, they should be in the dark. If you stress them, then the amount of this toxin in the skin will increase. So there's ways that can sort of make that situation worse. But certainly fibromyalgia, those sort of conditions, very definitely nightshades, thinking differently for people who have the sort of ear issues, so itchy ears, congested ears and sinuses, those sort of issues, that's dairy. And with dairy, you could be looking at the protein in the dairy, or you could be looking at the sugar in the dairy. So obviously the sugar is lactose, and so we need lactase to break that down. If you don't have lactase, then you can get the sort of stomach cramps, that sort of diarrhea, those sort of issues. And with the protein, it tends to be more, I'd say, the itchy ears and blocked ears, lots of ear infections as a child, you know, those sort of issues with dairy. But I also find that dairy is such a big spectrum of foods, because the more fermented you go with the foods, the less of those allergens, well, really, the more broken down those allergens become, and therefore, the less of a problem. So if you start off with milk at the top level, then that's very allergenic. But then cheese is a little bit more fermented, so that's not quite as bad. Yogurt, more fermented again, so much more tolerable for a lot of people. And butter at the bottom, very, very rarely I find that upsets people, because by the time you get down to that level, there's almost no lactose or protein left in it. It's you know, very, very largely just fat. So if you have a cow's milk problem, then you might be okay with goat's milk, or you might be okay with sheep's milk products like sheep's cheese. So there's a whole sort of section there about dairy. And what's also useful to know is that dairy intolerance, or particularly lactose intolerance, can be secondary to gluten intolerance. Because as we know with gluten, it's a bit like a Brillo pad in your intestines, and it's wearing away the top of the villi, and the top of the villi is where the enterocytes live that actually have that lactase enzyme. So if you've worn those away, then you know you don't have the enzyme you need. And I'm not talking about celiac disease now. I'm not talking about completely removing the villi. I'm just talking about the very, very tips of them. That can be enough to give you a secondary lactose intolerance. So if you deal with the
Helen, I was going to say that's really sort of, I mean, I didn't actually sort of appreciate that, you know, obviously thinking about it, and you've pointed it out, that's really, you know, like, yeah, I don't think, you know, you make the, what do you call it, sort of one and one added on two there. But yeah. What I was going to say is, sorry to interrupt, I was just thinking as you were talking, you mentioned that you were interested in finding the why. When I was a kid, and I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, nobody had intolerances that I am aware of. Perhaps I just didn't know because I was a kid. But, you know, what's your comment about the why? Why is it that we've got these issues? I mean, the foods, you know, obviously can cause an issue, but what is the root cause in your estimation of why?
I think it's multifactorial. So the whole gluten issue is a very, very, very big issue. Gluten, the way it's grown now, is not the same grain as it was in our parents' generation. And it used to be sort of waist high, and now it's knee high, because that makes it easier for combine harvesters to harvest. And also it's sprayed with glyphosate just before harvest to desiccate the grains, to make them easier to come out in the threshing. And I don't know if you've seen, but there has been a case in America where Monsanto, who make glyphosate, so known as Roundup, that's the term most people will probably be familiar with, there's a case now where somebody has actually sued Monsanto. He's this poor gentleman has got cancer, and he's sued Monsanto for damage caused by glyphosate, and he's actually won the case. It's the first time it's happened. And I think in my clinic, I see lots of issues which are caused by environmental reasons, pesticides, herbicides, you only have to look at things like the things we're very familiar with, like the Clean 15 and Dirty Dozen, you know, and just look at how much these crops are sprayed to know that you can't wash all that off. And for most people, that when they're not eating organic all the time, then they are ingesting some of those products as well. And also, I think science is advancing to recognize that it's not big amounts of these toxins that cause the problems. It's actually really small amounts. You know, it's more like the endocrinologist view of the world of, you know, one drop in a swimming pool, sort of that sort of amount can be detrimental to us. So we have a very large toxic load, I think, and that influences the state of our body, influences the immune system, it influences the biggest thing of all in terms of food intolerances, leaky gut.
Yeah, so well, is that sort of, you know, where's this all going environmentally? Because obviously it is the glyphosate, but presumably it's other factors. You mentioned it's multifactorial. So are there any other big factors that you would include in that?
So, you know, general lifestyle things, like the amount of stress that people are under. I mean, I think, certainly in my practice, I don't see anybody who says they're not stressed. we almost consider it, oh, well, that's just life, isn't it? You just get stressed. Well, and when I say to them, well, what do you do for relaxation? And quite often they look at me very blankly. Oh, I don't have time for that. But you have time to be ill. So, you know, again, bearing in mind that our stress response drives illness in the body, you know, if we don't modulate it appropriately. And when I say to people, well, do you do anything like, you know, meditation, or do you go for a little walk after your lunch, or, you know, do you just stop every so often and smell the flowers? And life is so precious that they're not really doing any of that. And I've had a few clients where, you know, who've come in with a lot of food intolerances, and I've sent them away to, you know, find what is your appropriate relaxation technique, and then do it and tell me how it goes. You know, and I've had one lady in particular who had sort of very masses of things wrong with her. And doing a lot of functional medicine, I tend to get those sort of chronically ill people. And she said, well, I'm going to put a hammock up in my garden, and I'm going to just sit in my hammock every day. You know, not for a lot of time, but just, you know, a few minutes, and appreciate the world around me. And she did, and she grounded herself on, you know, she would walk on the grass in bare feet. I don't fancy doing it in winter myself, but in the summer she did that. And by the time I saw her for her second appointment, she was hugely better. So I think we underestimate how much we can do for our own health just with lifestyle measures like that.
Yes. Yeah, so yes, yeah, so multifactorial. So when you're so how do you look at intolerances in clinic? I mean, how do you sort of start with somebody and try and sort of sort of get to the root of how you need to start with people?
So no matter what symptoms they're presenting.
I mean, I was thinking around testing. You know, do you look at testing, or do you sort of? So, you know, obviously there's lots of symptoms, aren't there? You know, if they've got the symptoms, then presumably you don't. Do you need to test, or do you test as a sort of baseline, and then that gets compliance? What's your view on that?
So let's just talk about testing in general, and then we'll come back to what I do. So a lot of nutritional therapists will be familiar with the sort of lab type of testing, where you do a finger prick, send it off, and it comes back with some sort of report. And I think there has been an absolute explosion in those sort of labs over the last year. So this is obviously a very, you know, a growing trend that we're seeing with more people presenting with these sort of symptoms of food intolerance. But another trend that I see amongst the labs is that more is better. So it won't just be a small number of intolerances. It'll be, you know, 100 or 200 or 250 items. And when you look at the detail of what those things are, a lot of them are not really that useful, I would say, in terms of foods. Because, I have had occasions where I've actually seen reports where somebody has reacted to pretty much everything, in my own testing, I'll come on to that, you know, I find they react to almost everything. And in that case, the last thing I want them to do is really restrict their diet. So I look for the, I look for just the key things, but just back to the test. So this trend, the trend that I'm seeing this year is for labs to go into more, I suppose, more sensitivity around what that IgG looks like. So they'll either give you a red, amber, green, or they'll give you a 1 to 5 rating. And the issue with that really is that even if they give you 5 foods that have got a rating of 5, then you think, oh, well, they're the worst foods. They must be having the most impact, so cut those out. But actually, there isn't a link between the sensitivity of the test and symptomology. So just because it comes up as a 5 on the test doesn't mean that really has the greatest impact on the client. And I think those sort of tests are really confusing for both you as a therapist and also for the client. So I prefer something that's much simpler. Sometimes I can go by the client's symptoms. So, again, I've talked about the itchy ears with the dairy, itchy ears, sinus problems, those sort of ear infections as a child, all of that, definitely dairy. Eczema, definitely dairy. Skin problems, definitely dairy, usually. Although, of course, there can be reasons outside of food intolerances, such as candida or other fungus, but we're just talking about food intolerances now. And for gluten, more often I see constipation. In certain people, it could be diarrhea, but more often I see the sort of constipation, bloating, changing your waist size as the day goes on. You know, I've had some clients say, oh, well, you know, I have to wear elasticated waistbands because I know by the end of the day my stomach's going to be, you know, I'm going to look as if I'm pregnant, whereas in the morning it was flat. So with those sort of people, I think definitely gluten. Let's see what happens if you don't have gluten. As I said, with the sort of pain presentation, with that I think definitely nightshades. And often people beyond those, you know, main things, people have some ideas themselves. So they might know that if they eat eggs is usually one they recognise as a, you know, if I eat eggs, it just doesn't agree with me. The symptoms could vary a lot, but generally I find people know about eggs. What else are the main ones? Legumes, obviously, they just get too much gas and bloating, can't really cope with it. Headaches sometimes too. But there is also something to do with oral allergies, where people have that itchy burning mouth, and they say, well, I don't really know. I eat an apple and I get this itching at the back of my throat, I don't know what it is. And those sort of things are linked to various pollens. So, again, there will be a time of year, there's a range of foods. There's quite a long list of foods with each different type of pollen. So whether it's, for example, silver birch, or whether it's, a grass or something. And that can account for why, again, with the lab test, you might see foods identified as an intolerance, and the person says, well, I never eat that food. How can that happen? And the reason for that is that biochemically, that food is very like the pollen, which is the thing that they're actually allergic to. And the body gets confused, and because it's similar, it just thinks, oh, right, yep, that's the same thing. So I'm gonna cause an immune reaction. So I tend to go by...
Yes, it's interesting... You giving us your view on this without me butting in the whole time. But so with the results, do you exclude all the foods, those foods, Helen, or do you what
absolutely,
do you
absolutely not? So I right. exclude what I consider the top,
the big ones.
Irritants.
Because it's about strengthening the system, isn't it? I mean, otherwise you just make people really intolerant to everything. Is that a myth, or is that absolutely true?
So I think if somebody shows for a lot of foods on those tests, all that tells you is they've got leaky gut. And I think it's far better for them to be able to have the nutrients in all of those, I would call them secondary foods, and work on healing the gut at the same time. And just avoid the things that are causing that that leaky gut. Prime ones being gluten, alcohol, and gluten in all its forms and in all the grains that it could be in, alcohol and stress. And looking at those things and healing the gut, I find within usually within 3 months, all of their symptoms are gone. So that doesn't mean that they can go back to the diet they had before, because typically the diet is, you know, it's not just the fact they've got intolerances, it's that they don't eat enough vegetables, and, you know, we all know that story. So it's not that they should go back to how they ate before, but all those secondary things, like all the vegetables that they couldn't eat, or different fish or different meat, you know, those things can usually be, I find, sorted out really quickly. And I had one lady who came to see me who was in her 70s, and all she was eating was boiled chicken and rice. That was it. No vegetables, no fruit, no legumes, not just chicken and rice, because that was the only thing she could tolerate. She was quite thin.
How did she come to that? I mean, was it something she'd done herself, or just like...
Yeah, over many years.
Reacting to everything.
She found that more and more things upset her. So, you know, initially she probably had low stomach acid as a cause.
I think this is the problem in a way with those tests that just look at, you know, you're allergic to, or intolerant to this and this, which is people do eliminate that without doing work of strengthening the system. You know, as you said, stress and lifestyle and all of these things have a bearing, and you can't just really separate one from the other, really, can you?
No, and the last thing you want to do is eliminate all those foods, because it just restricts the amount that's left. And then if you're not healing the gut, then you just end up with more food intolerances. You know, you end up with intolerances to the things you're still eating.
So when you're looking, though, at the dietary kind of strategy to this, and you're looking at elimination diets, how can you actually give them sort of more rather than less? And how do you reintroduce the food so that, you know, that they're not intolerant forever? I mean, is there a strategy you apply? I'm sorry, it's giving you rather a lot of questions altogether, but that's given you some some food for thought to how to answer that.
Yes. So what I do is, as I say, I eliminate the main things. So certainly gluten and dairy, or one or the other, you know, depending on what they're presenting with. Maybe nightshades as well, again, depending on what they present with. Maybe eggs, if they say eggs are a problem, or maybe soy. You know, those are, I would say, the top ones that I see. It doesn't mean to say there aren't others, but those are the top things I find that make a difference. So I eliminate those. I give them a food plan, so they've got things to have instead. So I always say to them, don't just cut something out and then, you know, not put something in its place. Your diet needs to be as varied as possible. So we talk about, you know, their lifestyle and what's going to fit. And sometimes, with some people, I hate to say it, but I do tell them just to go to the supermarket and buy a gluten-free loaf initially, because the whole subject of changing their diet is sometimes so scary. It's like, but what am I going to eat if I can't eat a sandwich? That I think, you know, what I really want them to do is eat a lot more vegetables. So if I can get them to eat a lot more vegetables and gradually cut down and then cut out sandwiches, then that seems to work very well. But there's no point with the sort of people that come to my clinic anyway, there's no point expecting them to do masses of cooking and, you know, make their own lovely flaxseed bread and things like this, because it's just not going to happen. So it's got to be practical. It's got to be small steps that they can feel confident about and, you know, do bit by bit. And then I give them some coaching along the way. So, you know, when they say, right, I've got my shopping organized for the week, so I know what I'm doing, and I've tried this food this week. Oh, I never had that before. That's quite nice. Or I tried this, didn't like it. What could I do instead? So I do things like that. If they're giving up tomatoes, usually people who shouldn't eat tomatoes eat a lot of them. Tomatoes in the sandwiches, tomato in pasta, you know, they'll probably have a lot of pasta too, lots of tomato-y type sauces, and nothing tastes like a tomato. So, you know, what do you do then? Well, I give them a handout on sauces. So these are sauces you can do instead. I've even got a no-mato sauce that uses carrot and beetroot. it doesn't taste like tomato, but it makes a very passable pasta sauce, so that they don't have to feel that, you know, everything they want is completely taken away. I think that's really key. So we do that. So that they have to eliminate whatever those key foods are for 3 months. And sometimes they say, oh, I'm feeling so much, you know, after a month or two, I'm feeling so much better. Can't I bring them back in? Not yet. So, you know, in that 3 months, I'm trying to up their vegetables all the time. And a good number for me is 10. 10 vegetables and 2 fruit. So trying to keep the fruit, you know, quite low. Still have some, but because of the sugar, which can cause other problems. So just keep it fairly low. 10 veggies. And then, you know, we'll talk about ways of getting in the 10 veggies. So are they doing roasted veggies? Are they doing soups? Are they doing salads? Are they doing smoothies? All those little good things that we know about. And that sort of puts the focus then on giving them a really good, balanced diet rather than it all being, so it's adding, you know, it's a sense of adding things they've not tried before, making it interesting and exciting rather than it being, I can't have that. I'm not allowed to have that. And making it, you know, they're almost, I can't think of the word. Oh, it's gone clean out of my head. You know, as if they're almost like a martyr to it. You know, I don't want them to feel that. I want them to feel that this
is an exciting journey. Yes, I think that's important. You need to feel comfortable. Otherwise, people don't do any of it. It's not, I think when I was practicing, you know, having been sent patients on, you know, how they get cheesed off and then go to another nutritionist. But, you know, it's kind of like that sort of just making them feel within, you know, even if you are coming to these kind of gluten-free loaf things, which we all know is not ideal, but you're not trying to be perfect. You're just trying to make them feel comfortable. And as time goes on, you can up the ante, but you can't do that straight from the off. Otherwise, they just won't do anything.
Exactly. It's just too hard and they get overwhelmed. So I try and approach it that way, and then when we get to the 3 month point, we do, and each time I see them, we do a review of symptoms. So I don't tell them what they said before, you know, because then they cheat. But you know, they just tell me how they feel now, and then, you know, I've got something you know, encouraging to say about it. And then when we get to the three month point, which is usually for, I think pretty much everybody that I see, that's the end. You know, they don't need to see me anymore after that. And then when we get to that point and I say, how do you feel now? And very often they say, well, I don't feel any better at all. Nothing's changed. And then we do this form just for their, well, you know, your symptoms, just mark your symptoms for me. So when did you last have bloating? Well, actually, I can't remember. And when did you have constipation? Oh, well, no, that's a lot better. And when I go through the things individually, you know, they're all gone. But the thing is, when people have these problems for a long time, they almost carry them, you know, they carry them on their backs like a satchel, you know, and it takes a while for them to realize, actually, it's not there anymore. You can let go of it now.
It's interesting that psychological profile, which is, I had that actually the other day in a, because I just do lecturing, so and somebody sort of said something like, oh, you know, I've got these terrible allergies. And I said, well, have you looked at how your gut might be contributing? Or no. They don't want to. Sometimes it's very difficult to change that because it's a label they've given themselves. And it's like, you know, I'm special because I'm allergic to everything. So, you know, that's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's quite interesting. And then they say, this has been quite useful, doesn't it? And then I say, right, okay, now the next thing we're going to do, well, the next thing they're going to do is reintroduce the foods, but only one. So I only let them do one new food every 4 days, because with food intolerances, it can take 3 days for that issue to show in their body, in whatever is their particular weakness. So they need to give it 4 days to make sure that, you know, nothing is manifesting. But I say to them, so don't just have it once. I want you to have a ball, really blitz it. You know, so if you want to go back to eating tomatoes, have tomatoes every meal. You know, have a pasta with bolognese sauce. Have you know, a lot of them, a lot. Because what we're doing is really challenging your body to see if that's still an issue. And so they really like that idea. So that, you know, they email me afterwards and say, oh, yes, this week I tried this or I tried that. And, you know, we may not have solved everything, but a great many things will no longer be an issue. And, of course, it needs that length of time, but only introducing one new thing means actually they are taking, you know, they're taking their time to reintroduce things. And, of course, all that extra time is time that the body is healing as well. So there's, you know, a greater chance of success. But I do say to them, so the gluten is the only one that I'm, you know, if they ever had a problem with gluten, I think it's probably a good idea not to go back to it. But if they really want to have it occasionally, then, you know, you still need to test it and see. So I just say, you know, but try gluten at the end. So try and introduce all the other things that you've really missed and see how they go. And then when you're happy with all of that, do gluten as the last thing. And most of them, you know, almost 100%, I think, say, well, I've got so used to not eating gluten, I don't really bother about it now. And so that, you know, gets around that whole issue of going back to what they ate before and then, you know, starting off the whole cycle again.
Yes, exactly. So how much success have you had? I mean, what's your sort of, can you think of, let's say, a particular patient that comes to mind that you can talk us through?
So the lady that, well, oh, gosh, several.
The lady that
ate the chicken and rice, you know, with her,
yeah.
I was thinking, oh, dear, this could be a little tricky because it was so restricted, because she had other health issues as well, as you can imagine, being on such a restricted diet, because of her advanced years, and the fact that she was seeing her doctor for this, that, and the other. And I thought, well, this could be a little bit of a challenge. But again, we did it on the basis of, right, I want you to introduce more vegetables. You know, what vegetables do you like? So we started from that. And, you know, how do you cook your vegetables? How do you put your meals together? Making sure that she was, you know, not just a lot more fiber, because if somebody hasn't had fiber, then suddenly having a lot can sometimes upset things a little bit. So making sure that she was having, you know, balanced meals, so she was having some protein, she was having some fat. Fat, I find a big issue with a lot of people, as in having some. and you know, the carbs were a reasonable amount, but not too much. So there's some education around those things as well. And she did really well. So again, she was quite clear on, well, I do like this, I'm going to do that, or I don't like that, I don't want to do that at the moment. And she was another one of these people who actually always had sandwiches for lunch. She had toast for breakfast. She had a piece of bread with her dinner as well. She used to have, and she felt really deprived not being able to have that. So sometimes when people are like that, I say, well, you know, I want you to try these things. So we agree what they're going to eat. There's no point in them going out the door and saying, well, I didn't see much of that. I'm never going to eat these foods. It needs to be things that are familiar, that they are going to try and introduce. And so we did that with her, and complete success, 100%. So when she eventually, and obviously I gave her some gut healing supplements as well, but the main benefit.
So what
that
do
she's
you give?
Already...
sorry to interrupt. I was going to say, what do you give on that gut healing sort of supplement?
So the thing The thing I find most success with is a product called Restore, and it's very good for leaky gut, and it's also very good for chelating glyphosate. So you do have to be a bit careful, and if you have somebody and you suspect they've had some toxic exposure, I always start on a very, very low dose. So the manufacturer says take one teaspoon three times a day, but I say start on, you know, just the tiniest drop on a spoon once a day and see if that's okay. And again, depending on whatever their particular weakness is, so it might be a headachy person or an achy person or, you know, whatever, if they've got glyphosate in them, then those symptoms will worsen. But then all I do is I give them Toxapreventer alongside it, and the toxic prevent mops up the glyphosate, and then the Restore can get on with healing the gut.
So who's the Restore? So, I'm not. What's the Restore product? Just because I'm interested. Who's that by?
Yeah, it's by Dr. Zach Bush.
Oh yeah, we know him. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, from America.
Yeah, that's right. He's made videos and YouTube videos and stuff on it as well, which tells you the science, which is
what's in that vaguely.
What's in it? That's a good question. I know it's based on some sort of, I think it's some sort of carbon molecule.
Right. So it's like a bit like the toxin prevent. In effect, it's drawing stuff out of the gut, is it?
Well, it does that with the glyphosate.
But it
has a particular effect on leaky gut. It's sold as a product for leaky gut. So for anybody who's not familiar with it, what I'd suggest is just, you know, YouTube it and watch his videos. They're really good. A lot of science to back it up. So I use that more than anything now. Previously I've used things like L-glutamine, but I found, only a small number, but some people don't react to that positively. And I don't really know why, but they don't. So I haven't, apart from the glyphosate issue, I haven't found anybody who has a problem with Restore. It works very well. And talking about those people who have dairy problems, there is a version of Restore which is like a sinus spray. Because not only leaky gut, leaky brains, leaky membrane, all of that. So you can use the nasal spray and actually really have a very good impact on those sort of conditions as well. And there's a children's version called, I think it's called Dirty Water, which is an odd name but appeals to kids. But I've used that with a few kids as well. So very good. So I just use that. As my main thing, and I find that, you know, that works, and I don't really need to use anything else. I do things like bone broth, 24-hour cooked chicken stew. As people become better with having more vegetables, then I encourage them to put as many vegetables as possible in that chicken stew. But again, making sure they're cooking it for 24 hours. We also do 24-hour yogurt, homemade yogurt. Again, certainly not initially for the dairy people, but after a while, that's good because, again, fermenting it for that long increases the probiotics in it and breaks down any of the proteins that could be causing problems. And that's what I do. It sounds really, really simple, but it works incredibly well.
Yes, and is that product available in the UK, or do you have to go to America for it?
Yeah, lots of places.
The natural dispensary, or
no? That's the one place.
No,
and I wish
right. It was. Well, we yeah, why isn't it?
Well, why I suppose nobody's asked. I guess it's from Amrita Nutrition. It's not quite as easy to use as a natural dispensary, but I get it from there. But there are the other places as well.
Okay. Well, I think in my capacity as ambassador for the industry, I shall feed this back immediately and get Michael to look into it. So Restore is basically by Zach Bush. And do I need to know anything else, or can I just feed it through to him like that?
I think that's it. There's various sizes of it. And as I say, there's the nasal spray as well and the children's version.
Okay, so a nasal and children's. Yeah, okay, that's really good information. Lovely. I'm writing that down so I won't forget. So have you got anything to add or something you felt that we haven't covered? Or first of all, we should say that this lovely book is available and it is called?
It is called I Don't Know What to Eat, The Definitive Guide to Food Allergies, Intolerances and Sensitivities, and what to do about them. And it's available on Amazon. By me, yes, by Helen Adams. And it's available on Amazon or on my website, which is www.oakmeadclinic.co.uk.
Well, it is a great achievement. I think, and I think the great thing about writing a book is it obviously forces you to, it is obviously forcing you to look into it in detail, you know, because you have to sort of, you're researching it as you go, you know, although you know a lot already, you have to think, oh, is that true? Shall I look that up? And, you know, so it's a sort of lovely process writing a book, even though, gosh, it's a real achievement. So well done,
It was terribly addictive. I think my husband was very glad when I finished it.
you're going to write another one?
I am, actually, yes.
Good.
November. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well done, you.
But, I found I was waking up at 3 in the morning thinking, oh, I could just put this in. Or I could just do it. I wonder what the reason is for this. And,
oh, well, yes, that's exciting, isn't it? Yes. Oh, well done. Well, are we allowed to know what the next one's on, or is it you'd rather hold your fire until you've started
I have two. I have two possibilities at the moment. So one possibility is to write about the low-fat myth.
And yes.
Really, is it what should we be doing? Because there is still some evidence that says low-fat is good in certain health conditions. But now we have a lot of evidence that's saying, actually, it's really not good in other conditions. And from public health...
Well, maybe it's just the wrong fat. I mean, you know, meaning if it's inflammatory types of fat, then obviously it's not good in some conditions. Or is it just, do you think that... I think probably the research probably isn't, what do you call it, it's a bit blunt at the moment on how it's...
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? In other words, it's a bit like saying vitamin C causes lung cancer. Well, then you look at the study and you say, oh, well, hang on a minute. These are people who already had lung cancer. And what kind of vitamin C did they use? And what dose did they use? And what other diets? You know, it's too, you know, then the headline gets out, of course, that vitamin C causes cancer. And it's like, hang on a minute. You didn't, you know, it's a soundbite in effect. So I wonder if just looking into the studies, it would be like, oh, yeah, well, actually, that the conditions that seem to be helped by low fat actually are using the wrong fat.
Yeah. Because I think in the nutrition industry...
You are the one to find out, Helen. You are the one.
in my training, anyway, it's always like, it's been, you know, oh, low fat, that's all history now. You know, fat is good. Good fat, you know, coconut oil, olive oil, it's all good. And in my functional medicine training, some of that was definitely, no, low fat. If they've got this gene configuration, you know, definitely they should still be low fat. And I'm thinking, well, that, you know, this just does not come across in the material that's available to us. And so, I, you know, for my own purposes, as much as anything else, I would like to know, you know, what is the right thing for people to do, and how can we get that the right message across to people. So yeah, that's one possibility. And the other possibility is just the whole area of healthy aging. So as I'm approaching 60, a lot of the people who come into my clinic are the older people. I think they see my picture on my website and think, oh, that lady looks nice. She knows what she's talking about. You know, I'll go see her. And in those advancing years, yes, you know, there's a lot of general stuff that's good. But as I say, I like to have a resource I can give to people and say, right, well, you know,
for more information. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, obviously the paleo people say, oh, it's all about paleo. But, you know, obviously those kind of diets were constructed, or a paleo diet was constructed around people who might have been relying on rapid growth and then snuffing at age 30 because they've been hit by a stone or whatever they were, or an obelisk or something, or a tiger. You know, they never lived beyond, you know, it's very difficult, presumably, to find people, you know, lots of people in a tribe who would have lived to an advanced age. So it's kind of like interesting that obviously in the modern lifestyle, you know, it may be that there are other solutions. But I think it's also, it's very important to look at nutrition in the whole, isn't it? To say, gosh, we can be so sort of like tribal and put our foot down about one right solution, and there's probably lots of right solutions, including eating as a family and, you know, and dialing down stress, as you said, and all of those other things. It's not probably just about the diet. It's all of
and I think even though nutrition is at the heart of what we do, I think it's very important to widen that to include the lifestyle things. And whilst I think, sometimes we almost get that feeling of, oh, but, you know, I'm trained in nutrition. That's what I know about. And I can't really talk about anything else. Well, of course you can. Of course, we all know what relaxation is. I mean, it is part of my functional medicine training, but we all know that it's beneficial. I don't think we need to have, letters after our name to talk about some of these things.
Absolutely. It's interesting because if people want to be rude about our type of nutritionist, they call us, in fact, Ben Goldacre, I think, called us lifestyle nutritionists as if that's an insult. I'm so happy with that title. You know, it's just like, who cares? As long as the patient gets better, it's not about our ego, yeah. It's about the patient.
Yeah.
So, let's just go with that. Only if you're really insecure, generally as in the industry is insecure, would you be sort of like, oh my God, I'm unhappy about that. Not unhappy at all. As you so rightly say, yes, nutrition is a big part of it, but it's certainly not everything, especially when it goes to allergies as well and intolerance.
Yeah, it's the other things that make that work. And sorry, I know we're out of time, but regarding the allergies and the sort of itchy, burning mouth and those things, I think what we're looking for there is histamine reduction and so things like quercetin.
Yeah.
Either in food or as a supplement work really, really well.
Fantastic. Well, that's really good advice. And thank you very much for your wisdom, Helen. I hope everybody rushes out and buys the book. So I'll call once again, I Don't Know What to Eat. It's by Helen Adams and it's available in all good places like Amazon and good practitioner book to have by your side. So with that and without further ado, I say to you all good night and thank you very much, Helen, for joining us today on the Nutrition Network.
Thank you. Very, very pleased to have had the opportunity. Good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Please subscribe to be notified of upcoming episodes.